treat obesity with appetite suppressants and quaaludes, which turned into the Miami Venom Institute to treat degenerative diseases with snake venom, was closed down by the FDA. Freddie moved it to Jamaica, where he came seriously a cropper with the government. Freddie actually owned drugstores, and he owned doctors, too. He had them strategically positioned across New York, and they would write prescriptions to his drugstores. He bought a stationery business and set up this tired old doctor with a script pad, and during any one week, there was $20,000 worth of pharmaceuticals coming in and going out of Freddie's various businesses. He never sold recreational drugs, but he did like to give his friends the same access he had. He liked to relieve them, he said, from getting it on the street. It gave him great satisfaction to contribute to someone's pleasure or to the greater glory of rock and roll. Freddie's costumes were terrible. He would wear cowboy boots with a leisure suit tucked into them. How do you like this? Pretty cool, eh? Silk fucking jacket and little hipster pants with a great big ass sticking out the back. Freddie's sense of fashion was absolutely unbelievable. It was Polish. He would have these girlfriends, and they would deliberately dress him up ridiculously and say, "You look great." A Hawaiian shirt and a brown nudie suit tucked into some cowboy boots, and they'd put a bowler hat on him. But Freddie didn't give a damn. He knew what was going on. He was always trawling for young girls and groupies down in the lobby. Sometimes he disgusted and revolted me. Three would look like underage chicks in the room. "Freddie, get them out. We're not going there, baby." One time in Chicago, there was a big party in my room and loads of bimbos, Freddie's groupies. They'd been there for 12 hours and I was getting sick of it. And I kept telling them to go and they wouldn't. I wanted to clear the room and no one would listen to me. "Get the fuck out." For 5 minutes, I tried. So boom, I fired a shot through the floor. Ronnie and Chrissy, his first wife, were also there. So I knew that there was nobody down in their room, which was directly below mine. And that cleared the room in a cloud of dust and skirts and bras. What amazed me was after that, I was stuffing the shooter, waiting for security to come up or the cops, and nothing fucking happened. The times guns have gone off in hotel rooms, and never ever has security or cops or anybody arrived. Not in America, at least. I have to say, I was using guns too much, but I was pretty out of it at the time. I gave them up when I got clean. A lot of people didn't like Freddie. Management hated him. "This guy's bad for Keith." People like Peter Rudge, the manager, and Bill Carter, the lawyer, saw Freddie as a big risk. But Freddie wasn't just getting high and bent on self-gratification. He had the weird, beautiful vision of, "Let's be who we are. It doesn't matter." Freddie was part of the 60s thing in a way, and he had that fearlessness. "Let's just break the boundaries. Who are we to bow to every goddamn cop, every accepted social correctness?" Which has got even worse. Freddie would have hated it now. It was just, "Scratch the surface. Let's see what's underneath these people." And mostly you find there's very little substantial conviction behind them if you just take them on. They crumble. Freddie and I knew what we had to offer each other. Freddie offered me protection. He had a way of filtering people out of the traveling gang. I can understand people seen Freddy Sessler as a threat. First off, he was very close to me, which meant he couldn't be reined in that easily. And that was basically 90% of the barrier. Then, I always heard the stories of how Freddy was ripping me off, scalping tickets and so on. So fucking what? Compared to the spirit and the friendship? Go ahead, pal, scalp as much as you fucking like. Switzerland was my base for the next 4 years or so. I couldn't live in France for legal reasons or in Britain for tax reasons. In 1972, we moved out to Villars, in the hills above Montreux, east of Lake Geneva. A very small and secluded place. You could ski, I did ski, right up to the back door. The place was found for me by Claude Nobbs, a mate of mine who started the Montreux Jazz Festival. I made other connections. Sandro Sursok became a solid friend. He was the godson of the Aga Khan, a lovely bloke. There was another one called Tibor, whose father was connected to the Czechoslovakian embassy. A typical goddamn Slav, randy little bastard. He lives in San Diego now and raises dogs. Sandro and he were friends. They waited around the exit of the local girls' college, and they'd take their pick. They were rolling in it, and we'd all roar around in cars, in my case, any type Jag. I made a statement at that time in an interview that is worth recording here. Up until the mid-1970s, Mick and I were inseparable. We made every decision for the group. We'd get together and kick things around, write all our songs. But once we were split up, I started going my way, which was the downhill road to Dopesville, and Mick ascended to Jetland. We were dealing with a load of problems that built up, being who we were and what the 60s had been. Mick would come and visit me occasionally in Switzerland and talk about economic restructuring. We're sitting around half the time talking about tax lawyers, the intricacies of Dutch tax laws vis-a-vis the English tax law and the French tax law. All of these tax thieves were snapping at our heels. I was trying to wish it away. Mick was a bit more practical on that point. The decisions we make now will affect blah, blah, blah. Mick picked up the slack. I picked up the smack. The cures didn't always stick through the periods off the road when I wasn't working. Anita had cleaned up when she was pregnant, but the minute she had the baby, she was straight back on it. More, more, more. At least we could be on the road together with the children when we took off for Jamaica to cut goat's head soup in November 1972. I had first gone to Jamaica for a few days off at a place called Frenchman's Cove in 1969. You could hear the rhythm going round. Free reggae, rock steady and ska. In that particular area, you're not very close to the population. You're all white guys there. Isolated from local culture unless you really want to go out and look for it. I met a few nice guys. I was listening to a lot of Otis Redding at the time and had guys coming up saying, "That's so fine." I discovered that in Jamaica, they were getting two radio stations from the US that could reach that far with a very clear signal. One was out of Nashville, which played country music, obviously, and the other one was from New Orleans, which also had an incredibly powerful beam. And when I came back to Jamaica the end of 1972, I realized that what they'd been doing was listening to these two stations and stacking them together. Listen to Send Me the Pillow That You Dream On, the reggae version that came out then by the Bleachers. The rhythm section is New Orleans. The voice and song are Nashville. You had basically the rockabilly, the black and the white, stuck together in an amazing fashion. The melodies of one with the beat of the other. It was that same mixture of white and black that brought you rock and roll. And I said, well, blimey, I'm halfway there. Jamaica in those days was not the Jamaica it is now. By 1972, the place was blooming. The Wailers were signed to Island Records. Marley was just sprouting his locks. Jimmy Cliff was in the cinemas with The Harder They Come. In St. Anne's Bay, the audiences shot the screen as the titles rolled in a familiar to me surge of rebellious glee. The screen was already perforated, perhaps from spaghetti westerns, which were the rage in those times. Plenty of gunmen in Kingston. The town was rife with an exotic form of energy, a very hot feeling, much of which was coming from the infamous Byron Lee's dynamic sounds. It was built like a fortress, with a white picket fence outside, as it appears in the film. The track, The Harder They Come, was cut by Jimmy Cliff in the same room we used to record some of Goat's Head Soup, with the same engineer, Mikey Chung. A great four-track studio. They knew where the drums were exactly right, and to prove it, bang, bang, they nailed down the stool. We were all shacked up at the Terra Nova Hotel, which used to be Chris Blackwell's family residence in Kingston. Neither Mick nor I could get visas to the United States at that moment, which partly explains why we were in Jamaica. We went to the American Embassy in Kingston. The ambassador was one of Nixon's boys, and he obviously had his orders, and also he hated our guts, and we were just trying to get a visa. The minute we walked in, we knew that we weren't going to get it, but even so, we had to listen to this guy's stream of venom, people like you, we got a lecture. Mick and I were looking at each other. Have we not heard this before? We discovered later from the visa negotiations that Bill Carter had conducted on our behalf that what they had in the files was very primitive. A few tabloid cuttings, a couple of screaming headlines, a story of us pissing against a wall. The ambassador pretended to go through the papers, talked of heroin, rubbed it all in. Goat's Head Soup, meanwhile, took some cranking up, despite dynamic sounds and the fervor of the moment. I think Mick and I were a little bit dried up after exile, and we had just been on the road in the US, and then here comes another album. After exile, such a beautifully set up list of songs that all seemed to go together. It was difficult for us to get that tightness again. We hadn't been in a studio for a year, but we had some good ideas. Coming Down Again, Angie, Starfucker, Heartbreaker, I enjoyed making it. Our way of doing things changed while we were recording it, and slowly I became more and more Jamaican, to the point where I didn't leave. There were some downsides. By now, Jimmy Miller's on the stuff too. So is Andy Johns. And I'm watching this happen, and I'm, oh, fuck. You're supposed to do as I say, not as I do. I was still on the dope myself, of course. Of coming down again, I said not long ago that I wouldn't have written it without heroin. I don't know if it was about dope. It was just a mournful song. And you look for that melancholy in yourself. I'm obviously looking for great grooves, great riffs, rock and roll. But there's the other side of the coin that still wants to go where As Tears Go By came from. And by then, I'd worked a lot in the country field, especially with Gram Parsons. And that high, lonesome melancholy has a certain pull on the heartstrings. You want to see if you can tug them a little harder. Some people think Coming Down Again is about me stealing Anita. But by then, that's all water under the fucking bridge. You get highs and lows. I would have been most of the time very, very up. But when he got low, he got very, very low. I remember joy and happiness and a lot of hard work. But when shit did hit the fan, it always hit it very solidly. You get exhausted. You get busted. For a long stretch, I was either on trial or had a case pending, or we were going through visa problems. That was always the backdrop. It was sheer pleasure to get in the studio and lose yourself. Forget about it for a few hours. You knew when it was over you were going to be facing some shit one way or another. Once the recording was over, having decided to stay in Jamaica, Anita, Marlon, Angie and I moved to the North Coast, to Mame Bay, between Ocho Rios and St. Anne's Bay. We ran out of dope. Cold turkey in paradise, par for the course. If you're gonna clean up, there are worse places. Still, it was only slightly warmer turkey. Nevertheless, all things must pass, and before long we began to act as human beings again, and then met some of the Rasta brethren of the coast. First, one guy, Chubbs, Richard Williams on the birth certificate. He was one of those full of brass, full-on guys you met on the beach. He was selling coconuts, rum, and anything else he could flog off. And he used to take the children out in his boat. As usual, it was, hey man, any chance for some bush? So it started from there. Then I met Derrilyn and Byron and Spokesy, who was later killed in a motorcycle accident. They worked the tourists in Mame Bay and lived mostly in Steer Town. And slowly, they all sort of gravitated around and we started to talk music. Warren Williamson, Iron Lion Jackie, Vincent Ellis, Neville, Milton Beckard, a dreadlock man who still lives in my house in Jamaica. There was Tony, Winston Black Skull Thomas, and Loxley Whitlock. Loxley, who was the leader, so to speak, the boss man. They called him Loxley because he had a severe attack of dreadlocks. Loxley could have been a first-class cricketer. He was a wicked batsman. I had a picture of him somewhere at the crease. He was invited to join the Jamaican top team, but he refused to cut his locks off. The only one who actually made a profession of music was Justin Hines, the king of ska, late lamented. A beautiful singer, Sam Cooke, reincarnated. One of his biggest records, called Carry Go, Bring Come, Justin Hines and the Dominoes, was a huge hit in Jamaica in 1963. In a few years before he died in 2005, he recorded albums with his band, the Jamaica All-Stars, and he was still very much one of the brethren of Steertown, a fearsome place just inland into which I never would have ventured. Let's say I wouldn't have been welcome there. Before I knew them, I was eased in gently via Chubbs, and eventually I was allowed to go up to the Covenant, which is what they used to call their movable gathering. Come to the Covenant. You're welcome, brother. I mean, Jesus Christ, I don't know how important this is in their terms, but if I'm asked to go, I'll go. Quite honestly, you couldn't see a thing. The place would be covered in smoke. They used to smoke the chalice, a coconut with a huge earthenware jar on top and about half a pound of weed in it, and a rubber pipe coming out the end. It was a question of who could smoke more than anybody else. The daring chaps would fill the coconut with white rum like a hubbly-bubbly and smoke it through the rum. You set the earthenware container ablaze, bursting into flames with clouds of smoke. Fire burn, jar wonderful. Who was I to defy local custom? Okay, I'll try and hang in here. This is powerful weed. Funnily enough, I never flaked out. That's why I think I impressed them. I was a smoker for quite a few years before that, but never that amount. It was just like a dare in a way, you know, watch Whitey fall to the floor. And I was telling myself, not gonna go to the floor, not gonna go to the floor. I stood up and stayed with them. Mind you, I fell to the floor later when I got out of there. It seemed the whole population of Steertown was musicians, whose music consisted of beautifully reworked hymns chanted by voices and drums. I was in heaven. They used to sing in unison. There was no concept of singing harmonies, and they played no instruments except these drums, a very powerful sound. Just drums and voices. The words and the chants were already a century old or more, old hymns and psalms that they would rewrite to suit their tastes. But the actual melodies were straight out of the church, and many churches in Jamaica use drums as well. They go all night for it. Hypnotic, trance, relentless beat. And they'd keep coming out with more and more songs, some of them cutting-edge songs, too. The drums belonged to Loxley, with a bass drum that could be so loud, it was believed it could kill you, like a massive stun grenade. In fact, there were many witnesses to the story of a cop who unwisely ventured into a house in Steertown, and Loxley looked at him, they were in a small room, and said, "Fire burn," meaning hit the drum, giving others warning to protect their ears. Then he hit the bass drum, and the cop fell unconscious, was stripped of his uniform, and ordered never to return. Steertown was a Rasta town at that time. Now it's a much bigger junction, but then to go up there, you had to have a pass in a way. It was on a main road from Kingston. It had the crossroads and many shacks and a couple of taverns, but you didn't poke your nose in. Because even if you said, oh, I know him and I know him, other cats might not know who you were and just slash you up. It was their bastion, and they had no shame with that machete. And they had reason to be fearful. So fearful that they had to make themselves fearsome so that no cops were ever going to walk into Steertown. It wasn't long ago that the cops would ride down the street, and if they saw two Rastas, they'd shoot one and leave the other to drag the body away. These guys stood up in front of fire. I've always admired them for that. Rastafarianism was a religion, but it was a smoker's religion. Their principle was ignore their world, live without society. Of course they didn't or couldn't. Rastafarianism is a forlorn hope, but at the same time, it's such a beautiful forlorn hope. When the grid and the iron and the bars closed in on societies everywhere, and they got tighter and tighter, the Rastafarians loosened themselves from it. These guys just figured out their little way of being spiritual about it, and at the same time, not joining in. They would not accept intimidation, even if they had to die. And some of them did. They refused to work within the economic system. They're not going to work for Babylon. They're not going to work for the government. For them, that was being taken into slavery. They just wanted to have their space. If you get into the theology, you can get a little lost. We're the lost tribe of Judah. Okay, anything you say. But why this bunch of black Jamaicans consider themselves to be Jewish is a question. There was a spare tribe that had to be filled, and that one would do. I had the feeling it was like that. And then they found a spare deity in the unreal medieval figure of Haile Selassie, with all his biblical titles. The Lion of Judah, Selassie I. If there was a clap of thunder and lightning, Jah, everybody got up, give thanks and praises. It was a sign that God was working. They knew their Bible back to front. They could quote phrase after phrase of the Old Testament. I loved their fire about it, because whatever the religious ins and outs, they were living on the edge. All they had was their pride. And what they were engaged in was not, in the end, religion. It was one last stand against Babylon. Not all of them hung to the tenets of the Rastafarian law. They were very flexible. They had all these rules that they would gladly break. It was amazing to watch them when they got into arguments amongst themselves over a point of doctrine. There was no parliament or senate or tribunal of elders. Rasta politics, fundamental reasoning, was very like the bar at the House of Commons, in this case with a lot of stone people and huge amounts of smoke. What really turned me on is there's no you and me. There's just I and I. So you've broken down the difference between who you are and who I am. We could never talk, but I and I can talk. We are one. Beautiful. That time was when the Rastas were almost at their most serious. Just when I thought I was shacking up with this really weird, unknown sect, Bob Marley and the Wailers happened, and Rastas suddenly became fashionable all over the world. They went global just within that year. Before Bob Marley became a Rastafarian, he was trying to be one of the Temptations. Like anybody else in the music business, he'd had a long career already in Rocksteady, Ska, etc. But others said, hey, Marley didn't have no fucking locks, you know? He wasn't a Rasta until it became cute. The first time the Wailers went to England, soon after this, I caught them by chance, up in Tottenham Court Road. I thought they were pretty feeble compared to what I'd been hearing in Steertown, but they certainly got their act together real quick. Family Man joined in on the bass, and Bob obviously had all the stuff required. I respond instinctively to kindness, with no side attached. In those days, when I hung in Steertown, I could walk in any door and my every need would be satisfied. I was treated as family and I acted like family. Not acted, I behaved like family. Became family. Me sweep the yard. Me mash up coconuts. Me make chalice for the sacramental smoking. Man, I was more Rasta than they. I'd fallen in with just the right bunch of guys and their old ladies. It was another one of those across-the-tracks things. Just being accepted and welcomed into something I didn't even know existed. I also learned some useful Jamaican skills with the ratchet, the working knife used for paring and cutting, but also for fighting or protecting yourself, with a ratchet in your waist, as Derek Crooks of the Slicker sang it in Johnny Too Bad. I've almost always carried a knife, and this one requires a special technique. I've used it to make a point, or to get myself heard. The ratchet has a ring to lock the blade. Just a little pressure, and you can flick it out. You gotta be quick in this game. The way it was explained to me, if you're going to use a blade, the winner is the one who can make a quick horizontal cut across the other's forehead. The blood will fall like a curtain, but you don't really hurt the cat that much. You just put an end to the fight because he can't see. The blade's back in your pocket before anybody knows about it. The big rules of knife fighting are A, do not try it at home, and B, the whole point is never, ever use the blade. It is there to distract your opponent. While he stares at the gleaming steel, you kick his balls to kingdom come. He's all yours. Just a tip. Eventually, they brought the drums down to the house, which was a major break with their sacred conventions, though I didn't realize it at the time, and we began to record there, just on cassettes, and play all night. Naturally, I'd pick up the guitar and stroke away, find out what chords might fit, and they kind of broke their own rules and turned round and said, "Hey man, that's nice." So I wormed my way in. I suggested maybe a harmony here could help, and I crept in with the guitar. They could have told me to fuck off or not, so I left it to them, basically. But when they heard what they were sounding like coming back on a cassette recorder, they loved it. Loved to hear themselves play back. "Damn right you're good. You're fucking unique, motherfuckers." I went down there for years and years after that. We were just recording the room. If I had some tape and we had a machine, we'd put it down, but if not, it didn't matter. If it ran out of tape, it didn't matter. We weren't there to record, we were there to play. I felt like a choir boy. I would just stroke a little bit behind them and hope that I didn't annoy them. One frown, I'd shut up. But I kind of got accepted. And then they told me that I was not actually white. To the Jamaicans, the ones that I know, I'm black. But I've turned white to be their spy. Our man up north sort of thing. I take it as a compliment. I'm as white as a lily with a black heart exulting in its secret. My gradual transition from white man to black was not unique. Look at Mez Mezero, a jazz man from the 20s and 30s who made himself a naturalized black man. He wrote Really the Blues, the best book on the subject. It was my mission, in a way, to get these guys recorded. Finally, when we were together in 1975, we schlepped everybody down to Dynamic Studios, but they couldn't handle the studio situation. It wasn't their milieu. You move over here, you go there. The idea of being told what to do for them was incomprehensible. And it was a dismal failure, really. Even though it was a good studio, that's when I realized if you want to record these guys, it's got to be in the front room. It's got to be up at the house where they're all feeling comfortable and they're not thinking about being recorded. We had to wait 20 years for that to happen, to get the take we wanted, which is when they became known as the Wingless Angels. I cleaned up for tours, but in the middle of a long tour, somebody would give me some shit, and then I'd want some more. And I'd say, "Well, I've got to get some more now, because I need to wait until I have some time off to clean up. I've had some lovely junky babes on the road, ones that saved my life, got me off the hook here and there. And most of them not low-life bitches. A lot of them very sophisticated, very smart women who were into it themselves. It wasn't like you had to go to the gutters or the whorehouses to find it. You could be at some backstage party and go and visit these society people. And a lot of the shit I've scored is because they offered it. These debutante junkies. Bless their hearts. Even then, I could never get being with a woman I didn't genuinely like, even if it was just for a night or two, or just a port in a storm. Sometimes they were taking care of me, sometimes I was taking care of them. And a lot of it had nothing to do with lust. A lot of times I've ended up in bed with a woman and never done anything. Just cuddled and slept. And I've loved loads of them. I've always been so impressed that they actually loved me in return. I remember a chick in Houston, my chunky friend, I think on the 72 tour. I'm out, fucked up, and I'm cold turkey. Bumped into her in a bar. She gave me some stuff. For a week, I loved her, and she loved me. And she saw me through a hard time. I'd broken my own rule and gotten strung out. And this sweet girl came to my rescue, moved in with me. I don't know how I found her. Where do angels come from? They know what's what, and they can see through you, cut through the bullshit look in your eyes and say, "You've got to do this. From you, I'll take it. Thank you, sister." Another was in Melbourne, Australia. She had a baby. Sweet, shy, unassuming, she was on the scuppers. The old man had left her with the kid. She could get me pure cocaine, pharmaceutical. And she kept coming to the hotel to deliver, so I went, "Hey, why don't I just move in?" Living in the suburbs of Melbourne for a week with a mother and child was kind of weird. Within 4 or 5 days, I was like a right Australian old man. "Sheila, where's my fucking breakfast?" "Here's your breakfast, darling." It was like I'd been there forever. And it felt great, man. I can do this. Just a little semi-detached. I'd take care of the baby. She went to work. I was husband for the week. Changed the baby's diapers. There's somebody in a suburb in Melbourne who doesn't even know I wiped his ass. Then there was the stopover Bobby and I made with two girls we picked up in Adelaide. Lovely girls who took care of us very well. These chicks had some acid, and I'm not a big acid head. But we had a couple of days off in Adelaide, and they were fine-looking babes, and they had a little hippie bungalow up in the hills, drapes and candles and incense and sooty oil lamps. So, okay, take me away. We'd been living in hotels, and we'd been on the road forever. And just to be taken out of our context was a huge relief. When we had to leave, because we had to go from Adelaide to Perth, which is the other end of the fucking continent, we said, "Why don't you come with us?" So they did. But we were still all fucking high as kites. We got on the plane, and somewhere halfway to Perth, Bobby and I were in the front seat. Both girls burst out of the John semi-naked. They'd been having it off together, and they came tumbling out, giggling. They were outrageous Australian Sheilas. We were laughing. "Go on, get 'em out." And we heard this collective gasp from the rest of the tube behind us. We figured we were on our own plane. We'd forgotten about the other passengers. And we turned round and there were 200 shocked faces behind us. Australian businessmen and matrons. Their gasps took the air out of the whole cabin. Some of them started laughing. And some went to see the captain and demanded immediate reprisals. So we were threatened with arrest at Perth Airport. We were all corralled for a bit when we landed. It was a close call, but somehow we talked our way out of it. Bobby and I were saying, "What have we got to do with it? We were just sitting in our seats." The two girls explained they were exchanging frocks. I don't know how they got away with it. They came with us to Perth. We did the gig, and then we left on our own plane. A cargo plane, a super Constellation. Leaking oil, no soundproofing, in all your own kit. Bring a mattress or two to lie on. We spent 15 hours from Perth to Sydney. You could raise your voice, it wouldn't matter. It was like being in a World War II bomber without the Benzedrine. And we obviously made the most of it. We knew these chicks a week. This happens on the road a lot. Very fierce relationships form, and then they're gone. It's almost a flash. I was really close to her. I really liked her. I almost remember her name. It's not like I was collecting. I'm not Bill Wyman or Mick Jagger, noting down how many I've had. I'm not talking about shagging here. I've never been able to go to bed with a woman just for sex. I've no interest in that. I want to hug you and kiss you and make you feel good and protect you and get a nice note the next day. Stay in touch. I'd rather jerk off than just have a piece of pussy. I've never paid for it in my life. I've been paid for it, though. Sometimes there's a backhander. I love you too, and here's some smack. Sometimes I get into it just for fun. Can you pull her? Let's see if you can. Try your best line. Usually, I was more interested in chicks who weren't slavering and falling all over me. I'd be hanging out and go, "Let's try the wife of the banker." I remember once in Australia, I had a room opposite Bill Wyman's, and I found out he had a deal with the doorman because there was something like 2,000 chicks outside the hotel. That one in the pink? No, not that one in the pink. That one in the pink. He had loads of chicks up there that day, and none of them stayed more than 10 minutes. I don't think any of them got much more than the insipid cup of tea that Bill likes. Some hot water with a little milk in it and a dip of a tea bag. It was just too short for anything to happen and get dressed again. None of them emerged disheveled, so to speak. But then it would go down in the book. Had that one. I counted 9 in 4 hours. He wasn't shagging them, so I presume he was auditioning them. "You from around here?" Bill was just blatantly like that. The weird thing is that, as different as they seem, Bill Wyman and Mick Jagger were actually very similar. That would rankle Mick like a motherfucker, me saying that. But if you saw them together on the road, or read their diaries, they were basically the same. Except Mick's got a bit of class, standing at the front, being the lead singer and la la la. But if you saw them off stage and what they were doing, how many did you have tonight? They were the same. Different from teeny boppers or the queues of chicks waiting for tea with Bill Wyman were their groupies. I'd like to vindicate them as the fine young ladies they were, who knew what they wanted and knew what to provide. There were a few blatant opportunists, like the plaster casters who went around trying to get an impression of every rock and roll player's cock. They didn't get mine. I won't go through that. Or the butter queens, rivals to the plaster casters. I've got to admire their moxie, but I don't like professionals who go around predatorily, had him. It's like a Bill Wyman in reverse, you know. I was never interested in that lot. I would deliberately not fuck 'em. I'd tell them to get undressed and go, okay, you can leave now. Because you knew you were going to be chalked up on scoreboards. But there were loads of groupies out there that were just good old girls who liked to take care of guys. Very mothering in a way. And if things got down to that, okay, maybe go to bed, have a fuck. But it wasn't the main thing with groupies. Groupies were friends, and most of them were not particularly attractive. They were providing a service. You got in a town, Cincinnati, Cleveland, and there would be one or two chicks who you knew would come by and make sure that you were okay, take care of you, make sure you ate properly. They banged on the door and you'd look through the little hole and say, oh, it's Shirley. The groupies were just extended family, a loosely framed network. And what I really liked was there was no jealousy or possession involved in any of it. In those days, there was a kind of circuit. Play Cincinnati. Next, you're going to be playing Brownsville. Then you're going down to Oklahoma. There was a sort of route, and they'd just pass you on to their next friend down the road. You go in there and ask for help. Baby, I'm dying out here. I've done 4 shows. I'm croaking. And they were nurses, basically. You could look upon them more like the Red Cross. You know, they'd wash your clothes, they'd bathe you and stuff. And you're going, why are you doing this for a guitar player? There's a million of us out there. Flo, who I've already mentioned, was one of my favourites. Lived in L.A., one of a band of black chicks. Flo had another 3 or 4 groupies around her. If I was a bit short of weed or whatever, she would send her crew out. We slept together many times. Never fucked, or very rarely. We just crashed out or stayed up and listened to music. A lot of it was to do with music. I had the best sounds, and they would bring me their local sounds that had just come out. Whether you ended up in bed together, it's immaterial, really. Bobby Keys and I got into further trouble at the end of the Far East tour in early 1973. In fact, Bobby got into such bad trouble, he might still be doing time now, but for a deus ex machina of intervention. It was Pineapples this time that came to his rescue. We had played Honolulu as the first gig of the tour. Honolulu was the point of exit and re-entry into the United States for this tour, which had taken us to New Zealand and Australia. You had to register musical instruments on the way out of Hawaii and had the list checked on the way back to prove you weren't importing goods. Bobby should tell the story since he is the main protagonist. Keith and I and the Rolling Stones tour Australia and the Far East, early in 1973. That's back when Dr. Bill used to travel with us, and they were concessions of self-medication for Keith and me to relieve the stress of the road. We're on our way back, and we go through customs in Hawaii. I've got all my saxophones with me, and they want to check the serial numbers to make sure they're the same horns I took out. So the guy's got to turn the horn upside down because the serial numbers are printed upside down. Well, the minute this guy turns the saxophone around, I hear this rattling sound. Oh, God. I know what that is. Boing. Right on the desk, out comes a syringe and sticks in the desk in front of the customs guy. So one thing naturally leads to another. Keith is there with me. We're in the same line. They separate us immediately, take me away, and give me the whole rub down, and find these large capsules full of smack and what have you. They're just soaking it up. The booking guy's made his fucking ears quota now. He's just rattling that typewriter. Oh, boy. We nailed a kingfish and his sidekick now, buddy. This is it. Yeah, we got the menu on these boys. And they do. They've just taken our pictures, and we've given them our prints. And they're just having so much fun out there. Hey, hey, 10 years. 10 years. Being the very end of the tour, there wasn't really an entourage at all. Everybody had split. I was allowed one phone call. Meanwhile, they've got me, and they've got nothing. I was traveling clean. They'd gone through me with a fine-tooth comb. I'm presuming that Bobby is now definitely in the clink. There's no way you can have a syringe come flying out and get away with it. I need a phone call because I know Bobby's going to need a lawyer. So I'm going through pains to call Frisco, L.A., to get him a mouthpiece. Finally, they let me on the next connection to Frisco. I get in the queue to get on the plane. And who's fucking there ahead of me? But Bobby Bloody Keys, what the fuck are you doing here, baby? They just put me through the goddamn grinder. How come you're here before me? Says Bobby. I made a phone call. You made a phone call? Who to? To Mr. Dole. This man, Mr. Dole, was the big pineapple exporter. The Pineapple King of Hawaii. You ever opened up a can of Dole pineapples? You know who he is. And he also owned the franchise of a professional football team of the World Football League. And Keith and I somehow had run into his daughter when we played Hawaii on the way to Australia. And she invited us up to the house for an afternoon with her and some of her friends, lovely, lovely ladies, all tanned, tanned, and rich. Everything was nice and friendly, and phone numbers were exchanged, and we had an enjoyable evening that went on into the night, and I got real friendly with Mr. Dole's pretty daughter, and I'm sure we drank lots of pineapple juice. This was before security. We were let loose on the world on our own then, so all sorts of shit happened. We're here and doling it out at the mansion. And in the morning, Mr. Dole comes in, and there's this sort of embarrassed, "Oh, Daddy?" He sees this bacchanal scene in his lounge with Keith Richards and me, and his daughter says, "Let me introduce you to my new friends." Keith's just out the door like a shadow, but Mr. Dole, instead of calling the dogs and saying, "Eat these people," says, "Very happy to meet you." Daddy is actually gracious. This is uncomfortable as hell because I'm screwing the pineapple princess. Mr. Dole gives me his card, saying, "Well, obviously you're my daughter's friends. If there's ever anything I can do for you if you're passing through Hawaii, give me a call. Here's my private number. Go straight through." So I take Mr. Dole's card, put it in my wallet, and don't think any more about it. Now, on the verge of many years of hard labor in the Texas sun, I have my one phone call, and I don't have any numbers to contact anybody. Nobody from the Stones party knows where the hell we are. Then I find Mr. Dole's card in my wallet, the only card I have and the only number I have. So I call this number, and I amazingly get through to Mr. Dole. And I say, "Mr. Dole, do you remember that scantily clad guy and that half-dead-looking Englishman who were in your living room the other day? Well, this is half of them." "Oh, hello, Bobby. How are you?" I say, "We've had a little problem here. They found this and that and syringes, and we don't know what to do." And he says, "Where are you? What happened exactly? What flight were you on?" And I tell him, and he says, "Well, I'll see what I can do." And he hangs up. Now, I don't know what's happening to Keith, but I'm scared to death. I thought we were really going to Leavenworth. I was just waiting for the guys to come with the chains and take us away. So I'm sitting back there, partitioned off by this mirror glass from these clowns that have booked us, and all of a sudden, the phone rings at this guy's desk, the one who's been talking all this shit at us, and you can tell just by the change in his posture that something has got him going. He looks back at me, looks back at the phone, hangs the phone up, and he just kind of shakes his head very slowly and tears up the charge sheet. They give the shit back, put us on the plane and say, "Don't ever do this again." And we fly happily off into the sunset. But it doesn't finish there. We get on the plane and I'm going, "Fuck, man. Better make some phone calls to get some shit for Frisco when we get there. Know anybody in Frisco? Who do we call?" Now, for some reason, I pull out my wallet. I immediately feel these two unfamiliar bumps under its skin. Unmistakable. In there are two 00 caps full of smack, which is a damn good whack of pure heroin. The caps came from the chicks in Adelaide, our Sheilas. Customs had been through me like a dose of salts. They'd searched me, they'd been up my ass. If I'd been busted, I would never have got back in the country again. How did they miss him? You find that a lot with customs people. If you think you're clean, you are. And I was totally convinced I had cleaned out my shit. So I immediately went to the bathroom and suddenly, everything went rosy. We'll share one cap now. Snort it because we don't have any needles. That will keep us going, and then we can make phone calls when we get there. Another close shave. The dog that didn't bark in the night. Bobby and I seem to be lucky in combination, especially at airports in those years. Once, going through security in New York, Bob was taking care of the baggage. One bag of mine had to go in the hold. It couldn't go through checks. It had a shooter, my .38 special, in it, with 500 rounds of ammunition. I used to carry a lot of heat. None of my guns were legal. I'm not allowed to own firearms. I'm a convicted felon. In the hold, it would have been cool as part of the general baggage. And Bobby got it fucking wrong. And I saw the bag with the shooter in it going through the X-ray. Fuck! No! I yelled out, Bob! And everybody, that's looking at the machinery, turned round and looked at me and took their eyes off the screen. They did.